you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
You have entered the Twilight Histories, an audio adventure that casts you as the hero. You will travel to fascinating, wondrous, and sometimes terrifying worlds in the multiverse. A Carthaginian base on Mars, Egypt locked in an ice age, a Roman Empire that never fell. With the help of music and sound effects, each episode, you will be immersed in an expansive multiverse. Today, you will explore the Bronze Age world of the ancient Sumerians, the cradle of civilization. But this is not our world. This is a world out of time, and in the multiverse, strange things can happen. When you're done listening to this story, please join us on Patreon, where you will hear a bonus show that will expand this world. When you sign up to Patreon, you'll help support our hard-working podcasters who build these incredible shows for you, month after month, year after year. Listen right to the end of today's show so you can hear a sample of what you'll experience when you sign up. And now, for today's show, this is The Ruin of King Ad by Kevin Falbinese.
That which is not dead may eternal lie, and with strange eons, even death may die. Forgive me, I have a fondness for the works of Howard Phillips Lovecraft. His short stories were my introduction to the world of the ancient Near East, you see, though I have long left behind the dreams of slithering shadows and slumbering elder gods. But what we do here really does challenge the imagination more than any prose ever could. Wouldn't you agree? Well, that is why you're here, after all. I see you've expressed interest in a tour of ancient Uruk, but a perfectly average request. A chance to meet the ancient Sumerians, wander the cradle of civilization, and climb the great ziggurats. You certainly wouldn't be the first, but then, I see your tastes have hints of the fantastical as well. A recent trip to Chalcolithic Armenia and the peak of Mount Ararat certainly raised a few eyebrows around the office. So, I have a proposition for you. I'd like to offer you a different trip. One to a comparably ancient corner of the Near East, a destination which can only be reached by the hardiest and most determined of travelers. Perhaps in your journeys you've heard of this particular place, Irem, the City of Pillars. I assure you, this is not some crumbling fort on the outskirts of Dhofar. This is a thriving settlement far exceeding the splendor of anything you'll find on the banks of the Euphrates or the Nile. In the midst of the empty quarter, a remarkable Proto-Arabian tribe has built a city which outshines even the glimmering new capital of Akkad. It is a living dream, a marvel of human ingenuity and divine inspiration, if you believe in such things. Well, that look on your face says everything. We'll adjust your itinerary then. Now, if you'll join me in the staging area over here, we can conclude your orientation. We're sending you to Irem in the midst of some auspicious circumstances. Our readings indicate that a meteor struck the city, damaging the palace and killing many of the inhabitants. And from what our scouts were able to deduce at a distance, no one has left the city since impact, and no traveler who returned there has been heard from since. Hungry, envious eyes are looking keenly upon the city's misfortune. In particular, King Naram-Sin of Akkad is looking to plunder Irem and carry back its countless spoils. Normally, the desert wards off all who might threaten the city, but Naram-Sin has captured several Eremite merchants and intends for them to lead his forces straight to their home. He thinks the army have all been killed or dispersed by whatever doom has befallen Irem. You will accompany the Akkadian forces under the guise of a royal assessor. It will be your task to catalog all the goods plundered from the city and to record an account of whatever disaster has fallen upon it. Depending on the circumstances, you may be at leisure to explore around and enjoy whatever remains standing. Even in the event of minor resistance, I suspect you'll gain access to the city soon enough. We've provided you with the robes of an Akkadian official. I'm sure you'll find them quite comfortable. They've been woven with climate-sensitive materials, so you'll find them refreshing under the desert sun and warm in the dark stretches of the night. At least to an extent. We can't send you with much else, unfortunately, due to the harshness of the desert, but you'll have enough to carry out your work and, well, survive in a pinch. Now then, let's get you suited up. Very good. Quite a respectable look indeed. You would be the envy of any noble this side of Byblos or Tyre. Now, please proceed to the platform and we'll get you on your way. I hope Irem will satisfy your curiosity. I find it defies logic at times, and I suspect it still has many secrets locked away behind its walls. There is a prison within the bounds of what is now called Arabia. It has no guards, no iron bars, and no gates to trap the wretched souls who find themselves interred there. Where prisoners of the more conventional kind long for their hour in the fresh air, or the kiss of warm sunlight on their skin, in this hellish prison, the elements come in abundance, and in the extreme. During the day, merciless Shams blackens the skin, the rays of her unyielding star striking the flesh like a hammer to an anvil. And at night, cruel Almaka besieges the restless with frigid winds and shadowy specters conjured up by the union of the moon and the shifting dunes. This prison is known as the Rub al-Khali, the empty quarter. A vast sea of sand stretches out as far as the eye can see. For the fifth day in a row, you have awoken to the same bleak vista, having long lost track of what direction you're even going in anymore. Your ritual is to rise, give thanks that you are still alive, and then use a small hatchet to check your belongings for unwelcome guests. More than once, you've lifted your bag, only to find a scorpion scurrying out from underneath. At the very least, your high rank affords you the luxury of sleeping under a modest tent, only partially exposed to the elements. Other members of your camp have had to contend with the gods of the desert every day and every night. Still, your body is feeling the effects of so long a journey without easy access to food or water. It doesn't help that the day's journey begins in the twilight hours, your guides assuring you that it is best to press on while the sun is not directly above, burning away your vitality. The undoing of the camp goes on without much pomp and ceremony. The scant tents are packed up, rolled, and hung off the sides of large camels. Meanwhile, your uneasy guides, a flock of merchants in colorful robes, gather round the eldest of their number and confer over a curious metallic device. They point the contraption to the stars and then debate vigorously over what they've seen. The discussion is always quite hushed, and you've yet to get close enough to really see what the device is. Only the commander of your compact force, Nutesh, approaches the wealthy lot to confer with them, a hand always resting on his trusty axe. Nutesh, in contrast to the flamboyant appearance of the merchants, is a military man through and through, wearing little more than a leather tunic with studs woven into them, and a conical leather cap to which he has fastened loose fabric as a face covering. He's a large man for the time, easily standing at 6 feet, and he wears his hair and beard long and wild. While the merchants clearly have no love for the man, they dare not oppose the giant either. A curt conversation takes place, and shortly after, Nutesh signals to his men to begin the day's march. Scooping up the last of your belongings, you are helped up onto the back of a camel by a young Akkadian soldier, who is shivering in his military skirt and cap out of fear for the ornery animal. You're not so enthused about the ride either, finding the smell of the beast unpleasant and the rhythm of its unstable gait uncomfortable. The merchants show no such issues, themselves riding the beasts with little concern, save for the iron collars and chains which the Akkadian soldiers fasten to each of them, and which they keep firm grasp of. Nutesh rides at the head of the merchants, doing his best to wrangle his own camel and not break the image of an indomitable commander. Your column marches on in silence until the sun reaches its zenith, whence its steady pace slows to a crawl, and those minding the merchants look ready to collapse. Nutesh gives the order to halt, much to the consternation of the merchants, who themselves look totally at ease in the searing heat of midday. If these Eremites were just a little younger, it wouldn't be out of the question for them to wipe out the entire Akkadian contingent. So great is the disparity between the conquerors of Mesopotamia and these wanderers of the Sandy Sea. Hopping down from his camel, Nutesh approaches the elder merchant, seizing the chain fastened to his collar and nearly pulling the man from his mount.
"If we do not reach the city or a watering hole by sunset, I will chain myself to you and you'll drag my corpse until you collapse from thirst as well. Am I understood?"
The merchant nods, and turning, he extends his arm, pointing a dry finger at something in the distance. Nutesh strains his eyes, but sees nothing, shrugging his shoulders and threatening to strike the merchant across the face.
"General, I am simply showing you where the watering hole is."
There's just sand and the shimmer of light refracting and reflecting in the extreme heat. Perhaps the old man is seeing a mirage, and if so, it will likely be the last thing he ever sees. Still, he keeps his finger stretched out, pointing with unwavering certainty at what he believes is sweet relief from parched demise. You note how the elder merchant is at complete ease, offering a wry smirk framed by his wispy white beard. He has the air of a man born in the palace and not concerned with the toils of the common folk. Only his leathery sunburnt skin betrays a life spent crossing the sun's anvil. A death must have been a frequent companion on his trade missions to the lands of Sumer and Akkad. Otherwise, you cannot imagine how a man in his position might look upon Nutesh with utter, callous indifference. And Nutesh, growing anxious to mete out punishment, gives everyone the order to march to where the old merchant is pointing. You steer your camel as best as you can and keep pace with the column, navigating between several large dunes as you go. Progress, however, is slow, with the sun blazing overhead, sapping what little energy you still have. Even the camels become unruly, causing the slow march to become a crawl, as the Akkadian soldiers do their best to wrangle the beasts and keep them from running off with the precious few supplies you still have. You all lumber on in this manner until the old merchant calls for a halt. You nearly crash your camel into the rider ahead of you, causing both beasts to spit and bellow. A general commotion rises as the rest of the animals become irate, and it takes several minutes before the exhausted soldiers can calm them all. Nutesh casts an icy glare your way, sliding his thumb across his throat. One more time, and it's your head. The hulking man descends from his own beast of burden and joins the old merchant at the apparent end of your brief trek. A flash of sunlight against polished metal nearly blinds you, and when the stinging in your eyes lets up, you see the old merchant cradling his curious metallic device over what looks like a weathered fountain. Descending from your camel, you rush over, desperate to get a better look at the device. You regret your haste, with the relentless heat sapping even more of your strength. But at the very least, everyone is so exhausted that none bar your path. You come within a few feet of Nutesh and the old merchant, and you finally get a good look at the device. You recognize the thing instantly as an astrolabe.
It is, for all intents and purposes, an ancient computer, and in the hands of a true scholar, an instrument of divination in this antique realm. But you note that this device, much like the camels that brought you here, are somewhat out of place. The ancient Arabs would not domesticate the camel for hundreds of years, and the astrolabe is a device which would not be crafted by Greco-Roman hands until the zenith of the imperial era. And yet, here they both are, in defiance of sensible chronology. But then, if the land of Irem is hidden beyond the desolate wastes of the empty quarter, you would need beasts acclimated to the trek, and navigational powers far surpassing that of any explorer to reach it. Two other merchants approach the fountain, sweeping sand from within the basin with the sleeves of their long robes. The business takes but a moment, and they blow into the basin for good measure, banishing any grain which might remain. That job done, they nod to the old merchant and step back.
"Is this a joke?" Nutesh asks. "If it is, I will bury you beneath this pedestal."
"This is a fountain, a wellspring for the tired traveler. Allow me but one moment, and you shall find relief."
And with that, the old merchant carefully lowers the astrolabe into the basin. You can't quite see what's going on, but you hear a distinct click. And with that, the old merchant steps back and stretches his arms out, offering a silent prayer. Not long after, you see small apertures open at the rim of the fountain, and from them, pristine water issues forth, quickly filling the basin. From your angle, you can also see additional apertures open within the basin, likely to control the water level and prevent spilling such a precious resource. In a few moments, the basin is full, and Nutesh drives his face into it, guzzling water and splashing it all over his scorched visage. He pulls back from the fountain, his hair and beard drenched, his face lit up in an almost insane mask of laughter. A disbelief rings out among those in your party, and many rush to the fountain, struggling against each other to quench their thirst. They don't even notice as several other fountains rise up from beneath the sand, their basins covered by stone domes which unfold, casting aside the sand to prevent pollution of the water. The other merchants take advantage of these fountains before the Akkadian soldiers catch on. Once everyone and their camels have drunk their lot, Nutesh regroups with the old merchant. You stand as close as you can, listening in as the old merchant reaches down into the fountain, presumably to retrieve the astrolabe.
"Now then, if I've earned the privilege of living a little longer, might I guarantee a much longer life after this business of yours is done?"
"I'll consider it, but the only thing that will convince me is setting my hands on the treasure of Irem."
The old merchant smiles, then turning his attention back to the fountain, he twists his arm, presumably turning the astrolabe within the bottom of the basin. Again, a resounding click, and this time, no one can miss the outcome of this mechanized magic. Entire dunes crumble and slink away as a great stone mass emerges from beneath the sand. It's a ramp, leading up onto a stone walkway composed of black granite. The disturbance in the sand stretches out to the horizon and beyond, and once the stone walkway has reached its zenith with another click, you see that it is wide enough to accommodate three men marching side by side. It's a highway across the desert, connected to a much-needed pit stop for anyone braving the barren wastes. Your mind is set ablaze as you try to comprehend the sophistication of these ancient people. Irem, it seems, is a power not to be trifled with. Such technological prowess betrays a civilization far outstretching anything in the most fanciful dreams of Sargon. Foolish Naram Sin thinks himself the king of the Four Corners, but instead, he is little more than the emperor of bandits, hiding unwittingly in the shadow of a colossus. Curiosity stifles your tongue, for if you were truly loyal to the Akkadian court, you would advise Nutesh to withdraw and urge the king never to venture into these parts again.
that proud King Odd has never sought conquest beyond the wasteland of the Empty Quarter, tells of a realm satisfied with all earthly pleasures, and so confident in their own might that they do not condescend to crush the biting gnats which swarm at their ankles. Surely, the fact that your convoy has even made it this far is just a fluke, and any further progress will find itself met with unfathomable force before the walls of Irem. Upon finding the stones cool to the touch and capable of supporting the weight of a camel, Nutesh gives the order to march. You all ascend the ramp, and with no doubt about where to go, you begin the long march into the distance. An hour passes, though perhaps it's more. Relieved at least from the stinging of hot sands carried by the parched wind, you still labor under a merciless sun. The path appears to stretch out to infinity, but then, somewhere in the delirium of your journey, a specter appears on the horizon. At first, you think it's little more than a mirage, some phantom conjured up by the sirens of the sand. Thin, wispy spires rise up from behind the looming dunes, reaching for the blinding sky like the paw of the Sphinx. As you draw closer and closer, the apparent mirage balloons in size, and its form is less disturbed by the desert's distortions. In time, though you cannot be sure how long, you feel a decline. You slump forward, nearly falling off your camel. As you right yourself, the camel kneels, dropping you onto the ground. But instead of a face full of sand, you touch down on hot stone. Recoiling, you fall onto your back, then glimpsing something massive in front of you. Nutesh, his soldiers, and the merchants all gather before the immense obstruction. A wall, no shorter than 50 feet in height, rises up, a dazzling glitter emanating off the striations in the otherwise dark limestone blocks it's composed of. It stretches out at some distance to either side, with round towers at intervals of some 40 feet, capped with ornate battlements shaped like date palm leaves. Irem, the City of Pillars, is no fantasy carried by the whispers of the Bedouin. It is an oasis in the midst of the desert, an impossible seat from which King Odd maintains his radiant throne. And now, its stone gates stand before you, parted ever slightly, offering but a glimpse at the Arabian metropolis contained within. No guards rush out to halt Nutesh and his soldiers as they draw nearer to the city. No cascade of arrows rains down upon your number. Irem simply awaits its first visitors, beckoning. A ghostly call emanating from between the gates as a gust of wind blasts through the narrow gap. The order is given. Weapons are made ready. Nutesh instructs the merchants to enter first, still held captive in their chains. You all march towards the city, your mind bracing itself for what wonders await you within its walls. And with every step, you conjure more reveries. And soon, it is as if you are carried on an impossibly powerful gale, drawing ever closer to the famed Atlantis of the Sands. The city of Akkad, long since reduced to dust in your own time, was a remarkable sight when you first beheld it. The capital of the world's first empire was modest in its grandeur. A central ziggurat dominated the environs, with mud brick homes of various sizes clinging to the outer perimeter of the temple complex, as if huddling close to the bosom of a goddess. You remarked on the cleanliness of the streets, regular as they were, and well planned in a manner which would make the Romans envious. The large bridge rose up from the center of the city, carrying its working class over the tranquil waters of the Tigris and out into the fields. Not too far from the western gate, there was a small port where reed ships could offload goods carried from as far afield as Urkesh or Huria.
The palace of Naram-Sin himself was fitting for a king, but not much larger than the residences of the high priest and the chief scholars of Akkad. There was a courtyard with a carefully manicured garden, a banquet hall where guests from all of the subjugated kingdoms might feast under the watchful eye of the royal guard, and the throne room, spacious and decorated in bas-reliefs, all of which would afford a sufficiently awe-inspiring sight to anyone who came to grovel before the throne of Sargon's progeny. And yet, all of that is nothing compared to the splendor of Irem, or rather, the remains of that ancient radiance. The moniker, City of Pillars, is one rightfully bestowed upon the works of its masterful masons, and its botanists. Here, architecture is intertwined with the sylvan form, creating an oasis city. The homes are not unlike those found in Akkad, largely cubic and unadorned, standing some two stories tall. But from within each, and at the corners of each dwelling, tall, girthy palms rise up, their canopies stretching out to provide near-perfect cover from the brutality of the desert sun. You'd think you were standing in the midst of a forest, so complete is the dominion of the verdant multitude. A great effort has been made by the masons to imitate the form of the palms in tall columns lining the wide streets, with the delicate leaves of palms layered over top of each other, rendered with impeccable detail in stone. Each structure capped with spiraling palm leaves wrapped around the conical crown of Mesopotamian royalty. As your eyes finally descend from the canopy, you look down and also find narrow canals running the lengths of the streets as well, carrying pristine water around the city like its circulatory system. Safeguarded from the evaporating heat, it remains cool to the touch, ensuring a steady supply for all. Looking around the city entrance a bit more, you even come across fountains, once again mimicking the form of the palm, with water emerging from the mouths of Lamassu, four of them to each fountain, and, if you had to hazard a guess, perfectly aligned to the cardinal directions, so curious is the orientation with respect to the surrounding buildings. And Nebuchadnezzar's famed gardens would not even merit a footnote if Hellenic travelers were ever to stumble upon Irem. But the most striking of all of Irem's features is its utter silence. There is not even a breeze here, no bustle of crowds, no creeping of dust and debris against the sandstone tiles. Since entering the city, you haven't seen a single soul. And in fact, this is beginning to wear on Nutesh as he leads his column of soldiers and captives down the main road. He's on guard, but there are far too many angles of attack, for the array of homes and columns and trees create dizzying sight lines as you move from block to block. The only onlookers here are the statues, which rest atop high pillars placed more sparsely throughout the city, depicting heroic figures in a stiff stride, not unlike those of later Egyptian dynasties or of the famed Kuroi of Greece. The general outlines of the figures is Mesopotamian in style, with braided beards, flowing skirts, and conical crowns. But unlike the relatively simple figures and outlines of the statuary found in Naram-Sin's palace, these figures are rendered in exacting anatomical detail, with rippling muscles, veins, and even wrinkles creating striking outlines in the midday sun. Even Phidias and Pygmalion would be humbled by the lifelike quality these works. Rudimentary searches of nearby homes are conducted, attempting to root out an ambushing party. Akkadian soldiers kick their ways through doors and into their interiors, with the loud crashing and splintering of wood resulting from the ensuing inspections. But every time, they return empty-handed, save for a few trinkets of gold, ivory, and other precious elements which they stuff into pouches tied around their waists. The general merriment of looting goes on for quite a while, until a shriek resounds from within one of the homes. Everyone rushes over, save for a few soldiers left in charge of the captive merchants. Even you rush ahead, potentially into danger, driven on by all-consuming curiosity.
You pass under the threshold of the building, stumbling into a central courtyard where a macabre scene is laid out for all. You squeeze your way past several of the soldiers, breaking through to the front of the pack where Nutesh is inspecting the grim matter. The bodies of three Eremites, all swaddled in fine, colorful robes, lay collapsed against the walls of the courtyard, their flesh dried out and desiccated, as if they were a bunch of grapes left out in the desert at midday. Their mouths are open in silent screams, with rigor mortis twisting their already horrendous countenances into visions of hell that would confound even Goya or Dore. But worse than the agony of their final moments, mummified in dried flesh, is the thing, or things, which latch onto them, welding them to the walls. Long, fine, wispy tendrils emerge from the ground and the walls and wrap themselves around the corpses, gently pulsating and wriggling about. The movement terrifies the soldiers, and several of them squeeze out of the home, withdrawing from what they must fear is an unknown disease. Nutesh, however, shows little concern, instead taking his axe up and chopping some of the tendrils, causing them to recoil and withdraw back into the ground and the walls. You all shudder from the sight, you most especially, understanding more than the ancients what the dangers of pathogens and parasites are. Nutesh himself allows his shock to slip through, and he screams for the merchants to be brought in. The order has to be repeated several times before the older merchant is brought in and forced to his knees in front of the remains of his countrymen. He covers his face and rocks back and forth, the sounds of a garbled prayer slipping out from under his hands.
"What sorcery is this?" Nutesh asks. "What evil have you Eremites conjured here?"
"My city, my people."
Nutesh shakes the merchant, trying to get a straight answer out of him. And failing that, he grabs the old man by the neck and holds him close to the corpses and to the wriggling tendrils.
"I know nothing. I know nothing. I know not what this sickness is. Please."
Nutesh hurls the merchant on his back and then orders that he's dragged back outside.
"Royal Assessor, pay very close attention now. If we find more like this, there will be no garrisoning the city. Make sure the king understands that clearly in your record." You nod and then follow Nutesh back out and onto the street. You see all the merchants huddling around the elder, wearing identical grimaces. Nutesh signals to his men, and again, it takes more than one go to rally the uneasy soldiers. "Make preparations to camp outside the city. If we find more of the dead, then there is no question of remaining here for any length of time."
Nutesh walks over to the merchants, breaking up their circle around the elder, and once more, he takes firm hold of the weary soul.
"You will lead us to the palace. We'll recover what we can, and then we'll decide what to do about this damn place."
And with that, your expedition breaks into two, with a number of visibly relieved soldiers rushing out past the gates, while you, Nutesh, and a hearty few follow the merchants deeper into the heart of Irem. You keep your column tight as you march ahead, pausing at regular intervals for scouts to go out and search for any signs of resistance, only for them to return with word of more fallen Eremites and the same unknown infestation. The reports sap more and more strength from the merchants, especially the elder, and it's not long before Nutesh has his soldiers beating them and shaking them the moment they slow or stop to mourn a fallen Eremite in the streets. The further into the city you advance, the more of the fallen you find. All of them reduced to husks, not one resting as if they had peacefully shuffled off this mortal coil. Instead, they bear testament to the insidious and fast-acting nature of whatever it was that struck them down. Those, at least, who have fallen in the midst of the street appear to be free of the writhing tendrils from before. Only those who have fallen near a crack in a wall or within the confines of a garden are assailed by this mysterious organism. You notice as well, the deeper you march into the city, that the canopy becomes spotty, with trees withering and their branches sagging, and their fronds outright dropping onto the ground, only to shatter or to turn to dust. You try to work out what this blight might be, and you thank the miracles of medicine in your own time, which have largely inoculated everyone against diseases found both on Earth and among the stars. In your travels, you have certainly come across all manner of strange flora, including a curious mushroom consumed by the hermits of the Syrian desert. That specimen, as of yet uncatalogued in your own time and place, conjured all manner of visions and apparitions in whoever consumed it, outright killing the mentally unprepared and leaving others shattered, rambling messes upon the ground. You likewise recall a mysterious root consumed by the prehistoric inhabitants of Mesoamerica, which afforded them the means of communing with their gods. And, of course, you cannot forget the infamous blue lotus, imbibed in copious quantities by the heretic pharaoh Akhenaten, which led to a tense exchange as he set his eyes upon you and remarked that you were indeed a traveler from another realm. Nothing adds up, and whatever the case, none of the strange plants you've come across transmitted a disease, let alone one which might fell an entire population. Certainly, there are spores which could lead to delirium or difficulty in breathing, and some poisonous plants would finish off the unaware upon consumption, but you've never seen anything which could reduce the human form to a withered husk. And the tendrils, well, they're not the root of any plant known to science. Rather, you find them quite similar to the mycelia, which wind their way through the soil of the Pacific Northwest, breaking ground as humble mushrooms while spreading the white rot everywhere they go. But again, those mushrooms never killed anyone. Finally, as the canopy above has all but disappeared, you once again confront the harsh desert sun, and under it you spy for the first time the crown dome of what is surely the palace of Irem. The structure is easily in excess of 200 feet, outstretching the vast heights of the Hagia Sophia, though no less splendid in its contours. In fact, the dome, its ribbing, and the overall shape of the palace below hearken to the architectural splendors of the Byzantine and Ottoman worlds with eerie detail, presaging those feats of art and architecture by millennia. The dome has another reason to captivate you, however. With a gaping hole punched into it, the edges of it seared a deep black, and the fragments of stone littered about hither and thither. You recall your briefing before this excursion to the sandy wastes, and remember that Irem was supposedly struck by a meteor. The rock must have been largely eviscerated upon entering the atmosphere, for the hole in the dome looks to be little more than 20 feet in diameter. Whatever the case, the impact, aside from piercing the dome, doesn't seem to have caused much damage to the city otherwise. Unlike the organism, which is literally turning the city and its deceased inhabitants to dust. Nutesh orders a halt at some distance from the palace gates. Once again, two large doors confront your party, and once again, they are slightly ajar. No resistance is offered, no final holdout before the gates rallies to ward off your entry. And again, stark silence hangs in the air. And this time, it strikes a nerve. Nutesh levels his axe at the old merchant.
Let me make myself clear. If we are ambushed within the walls of the palace, I would sooner spill your guts out than save my own life.
No such thing is necessary, the old merchant says, touching his hand to his heart. I am at quite a loss for the silence, perhaps more so than you are. This was my home, and now there is not even a ghost to greet me.
He turns to the gates, crossing his arms and stroking his short beard.
What good is all my wealth if there's no one to spend it on?
I will personally see to it that your wealth is not wasted. Be assured of that, at least. Now then, you go in first, old man.
Nutesh rests the blade of his axe on the merchant's shoulder, taking up the chain fixed to the man's collar in his other hand. The Akkadian soldiers do likewise with the other merchants, and after a beat, Nutesh pushes the old merchant towards the open gates. You are forced to wait once again, with only a handful of soldiers left behind to guard the doors. You pace about, anxious to glimpse the interior of this mammoth palace. All the legends of ancient Irem and its towering denizens thunder about in your mind, conjuring the specters of Arabian titans descending from Mount Horeb to entrench themselves at the edge of the world. Further still, your mind races, taking you to the darker tales of this Atlantis of the Sands, wherein the unparalleled magi of Irem communed with the fiery djinn, producing works of magic and technology which mocked nature and her dictates. Perhaps, just beyond those gates, mighty King Ad sits atop his colossal throne like the gilded Zeus of Olympia. Whatever the case, you just don't know, and you can't wait any longer to find out. After what feels like an eternity, an Akkadian soldier emerges from between the gates and motions for you to join him. You hurry across the sandstone tiles and squeeze between the soldier and the heavy door, immediately stumbling forward and landing on your face with a thud. You taste dust and come face to face with ornate tiles, rendering fanciful geometry in lapis lazuli and carnelian. Someone seizes you by the arms and heaves you up. You nod to the Akkadian soldiers on either side of you and begin to beat the dust from your robes. You become so preoccupied with this that you forget for a moment why you even rushed in. But as you sort yourself out, you become aware of the sheer silence around you. And without even thinking about it, you look around, casting your sight upon a confounding vista. The interior of the Palace of Irem is not, at least at a glance, the trophy room of a haughty king, intent on displaying all the amassed wealth of the kingdom for subject and envoy alike. Where Naram Sin kept statues carried off from the four corners of his kingdom and displayed them alongside Stele commemorating his victories. But the Lord of Irem holds one treasure in esteem above all others. Water. Four great streams of water course out from fountains shaped like urns, each one held in place by the muscular arms of a bearded deity resplendent in gold. These four titans, crowned with conical caps fashioned in the likeness of conches, are draped in robes fit for Hammurabi or Sennacherib, and they're rendered with such detail that you fear that they'll come alive at any moment. But instead, they all cast their gazes downward at the void into which their steady streams tumble. It feels as if you've stepped into a well instead of a palace. Though, this is a watering hole on the scale of titans. The interior is cavernous, voluminous, and demonstrates the sublime craft of its nameless architects. Imhotep would be humbled by the impossible splendor of this abode, with its three upper levels girding the structure, raising the immense dome skyward, each supported by a forest of columns fashioned in the likeness of a Near Eastern Atlas bearing the weight upon his broad, muscular shoulders. Each of them turned to gaze upon the heart of the structure. Even the patterns on the splendid tiles give the effect of a whirlpool rushing towards the central space where the water cascades downward. You are overwhelmed by the opulence and the majesty of this place. Your mind races as you try to understand how the denizens of the Oasis City could have even quarried and transported the materials necessary to lay the foundations. How did they toil under the merciless sun to raise the blocks skyward, higher than any peak reached by the pharaohs? And which workshop employed a legion of artisans to help shape the colossi of Irem? And who set them to tunnel and carve their way down to the depths unreachable by the shaft of light piercing down from the hole in the dome? Who subdued the waters? And from whence did they come, carried and collected into reaches which never seemed to threaten a flood?
This city, it's more than I could ever imagine. But so far, there is nothing here of value to my king. Has the Lord Odd spent all of his treasury on stone and water? Or is there anything I can actually carry back to Akkad?
The old merchant raises a hand, and Nutesh nods, waving to him with growing impatience.
Speak.
The king believed that a cup of water is worth thrice the value of its equal measure in gold.
Nutesh raises his hand, threatening to strike the old man. The merchant gestures towards the hole in the floor.
It is custom in these dry parts to keep the most precious treasures at some distance from the sun and heat in the air. It is also law that all must store 3/4 of their wealth alongside that of the king. It is a guarantee that all share in the prosperity of the realm, and that no man may hoard an undue share.
There's a basement storehouse, then.
If one was to use such modest words, then yes. I myself maintain stores of frankincense, ebony, and scented oils not so far from the king's personal storage. There are stone chambers below, shielded from the moisture, and which are accessible only by the king's master key.
The old merchant beckons to one of his number, and with some hesitation, the merchant produces an astrolabe similar to the one the elder used before.
These tools, they're mere imitations of the ones used by King Ad. No man but the king or his vizier may open the vaults. Such is the law.
Well then, where is his key?
The old man gestures to the palace around you, and as you take a closer look, you do find doorways and gates branching off from other parts of the structure.
You don't know for certain?
The old man nods, bowing for good measure to stave off the growing impatience of his captor.
Very well. Search the palace. Bring me this key.
And then Nutesh turns to you.
And of course, take time to record your account of our triumph. Make sure the king understands the lengths I went through to please him.
You bow to Nutesh alongside all the soldiers, and then at a wave from your commander, you disperse out into the palace, wandering between the endless forest of columns, dreaming of the splendors yet to be uncovered in the chambers below. There are not enough glyphs in cuneiform to convey the overwhelming splendor and mystery of famed Irem. Even now, as you stand within the walls of its palace, you struggle to comprehend how the place exists at all. Not for lack of trying, you have found no account or even a hint of how an entire civilization materialized in the harshest reaches of the empty quarter, and you certainly have no clue about how that culture vanished, seemingly, overnight. As the sun finally began its retreat below the horizon, you struck a torch after uncovering kindling in a nearby storeroom. And while you left the soldiers to raid the jars of dried dates, figs, and apricots, you ignored your rumbling stomach as your hunger for knowledge compared you to wander among the pillars in the long, winding corridors which ring the structure, squeezed between the outer and the inner walls. Unable to see more than a few feet in front of you, the search for some morsel of information was a lengthy, exhausting affair. And indeed, you've come up empty for the most part. No bas-reliefs afford a tale of the city's founding, and in your wandering, you did not spot a single glyph carved into the walls to recant the annals of royal history. Instead, you are starting to believe that Irem simply appeared in some divine tempest, with a sandstorm raging and then dissipating to reveal the towering peaks, girthy walls, and daunting palace complex. The people themselves must have sprung up from beneath the sand, each fashioned to their task and equipped with wisdom far exceeding the age. What you did manage to find is scant. You eventually stumbled upon what you assume is the royal records, or at least the workshop of the scribes. At least in this regard, the men of Irem are congruent with their contemporaries, inscribing their records into clay tablets and cylinder seals. The workshop was long but quite tight, affording room for a scribe or two to work at long benches, both of which terminate in stations for mixing and shaping clay. Fortunately for you, the vanished scribes left enough water and dried clay around for you to fashion tablets out of them. You are here to do a job, after all, and with the help of the stylus, you conduct your craft. Your account of the journey here and of your discoveries is brief by necessity, though you make sure to cite Nukesh's name often enough to satisfy his vanity. You aren't sure if he's illiterate, recalling the harsh words that the Sumerian denizens of Akkad had for their Semitic overlords. Setting aside your own work to dry, you pick up a finished tablet and look over the cuneiform. While the symbols and general conventions replicate those found in Sumer and Akkad, the language here encoded is closer to Arabic, naturally. At the very least, you know that the Eremites were a Semitic people, like most of the ancient Near East. And, like the busy scribes of Uruk or Ebla, they mostly concern themselves with recording transactions. Most of what you found here accounts for trades conducted by the Eremites. Oils, resins, produce, cattle, and precious metals are all noted to the item, with the general quality of each good noted as well. It seems the Eremites would suffer no inferior product. And when the yield was of notable excellence, the scribes always concluded their record with the phrase, "Praise be upon the Lord Ad, founder and father of our people." You write that off as the usual sycophancy required in the days of cruel absolute monarchy. Irem, splendid as it is, could not have been the work of one generation, let alone the lifetime of one man. To build one of the Giza pyramids was the work of over half a century. Egypt was a project of millennia. But Irem's scribes were speaking as if they had exceeded even Roman engineering, building an imperial capital in the span of a few years. Assembling the materials alone would have taken a lifetime, and the harsh desert could never support the armies of laborers required to undertake such an impossible project. And yet, here you are, standing in the palace, still very much confused. Your time to ponder this mystery is cut short, as an Akkadian soldier comes to fetch you. Taking up your torch, you follow the soldier down a level and over to a large iron gate. Nutesh is waiting with the merchants, everyone holding a torch aloft. Once you join the group, Nutesh motions for the gate to be opened. The elder merchant receives a hefty astrolabe from the hands of a soldier, and then, in consultation with the other merchants, the gears are turned, constantly checking against the locking mechanism which binds the gates together. Once a satisfactory alignment is found, the elder merchant presses the astrolabe into the mechanism and, turning it counterclockwise, sets off machinations which slowly but surely unlock the gates. The Akkadian soldiers look on in amazement at the mechanical complexity, but Nutesh orders them to stand at attention. The merchants bow and gesture for Nutesh to proceed, but he points to the gate with his axe, prompting the merchants to fully draw back the gates and enter first. Trust is still in short supply, it seems, and you deem this level of caution to be prudent. With the sophistication of security on display here, it's not impossible that the Eremites have rigged traps to snare unwitting thieves. Though you wonder who would have need to steal in such a wealthy city. The doors are flung open and Nutesh rekindles his torch, making sure that it's well lit. Everyone else follows suit, and once they're all ready, the merchants lead you under the threshold and down a spiraling staircase. Cautious, Nutesh and the Akkadians mingle with the merchants, ensuring that any trap which is set off will doom the lot of you. The descent is gradual, following a winding staircase wide enough to accommodate two men standing shoulder to shoulder. You plunge deep into the earth, growing dizzier as you wind down the steps. Time seems to melt away as you follow the spiral further and further below the palace. Only the gradual broadening and disintegration of the four streams from above provides any measure of distance covered, as does the misty spray rising up from the depths as water collides with water. You corkscrew down in this manner for an indeterminate stretch, and when you finally reach the exit of the stairwell, you find yourself stumbling about, delirious. It takes a beat to regain your composure, but when you do, you find yourself confronted with another delirium-inducing sight. You expected to find a long corridor, bounded by vaults on either side, overflowing with worldly goods. Instead, you stand at the edge of a vast expanse, a cavern stretching out at a distance far exceeding the outer limits of the palace above. The broad vista is broken up by several platforms and large columns, natural in origin, and suitably girthy to sustain the weight of the structure in the city above. And below, the deepest limits of the abyss are concealed behind a thick, wispy mist. The light of your torches creates a disquieting array of shadows against the anomalous contours of the mist, as if to reveal a legion of djinn drifting in the underworld. Nutesh seizes a torch from one of the merchants and hurls it into the abyss, listening for what he believes will be the inevitable thud as it hits the floor. You wait much longer than anyone is comfortable with to hear the torch reach the bottom and fizzle out as it strikes water, long after the dim light of its flame was concealed by the all-enveloping mist. Fear seizes your party, or perhaps it's exasperation. The Acadian soldiers approach the edge of the landing and gaze out, comprehending the depths they are tasked with searching.
I am growing tired of this, you old fool.
Nutesh says as he seizes the old merchant by the throat.
How are we supposed to find anything down here?
For the first time, the old merchant kneels, groveling before Nutesh.
What now?
Forgive me. It was not so the last time I came down here.
The merchant grasps at Nutesh's feet, pleading.
The caverns have asked, but the treasure stores are right ahead. You only need follow the walkway. You have my word.
Nutesh heaves the old merchant to his feet and smacks him across the face. He shakes the old man for good measure.
If I do not lay my hands on Uramite gold right now, I will hurl you over the ledge.
That said, he shoves the elder merchant back into the arms of his compatriots. A long beat passes as Nutesh looks to what little of the walkway can be seen, trying his best to see far beyond it. He shakes his head, and after stepping out onto it for a moment, he waves his arms around, trying to disperse the mist to little avail. Frustrated, but without further recourse, he gives the order to march.
It's a straight shot to the treasure.
The elder merchant answers in the affirmative.
Very well. You know how this goes.
And with that, your party sets out into the misty depths. Torches held aloft, and little more than your imagination, and the promise of unearthly wealth to guide you onward. Your journey into the midst of the mist is a long one, with time feeling more like a fleeting illusion as you keep walking along the slippery stone, constantly surrounded by the eerie veil. Your torches afford you comforting, if limited, light, and a meager measure of warmth in the increasingly cold environs. Where before your enemies were the scorching sands and the unyielding sun, here you find yourself menaced by darkness and chilling vapors. There is genuine concern that the mist, which clings to you, weighing down your clothing with moisture, might dim and eventually defeat the flames which safeguard you against total darkness. It's tempting to hurry, but the walkway is slick, and without a rail on either side, there is a chance that you will join the merchants of Irem in their unfortunate fate. And so, you inch your way forward, following Nutesh towards what everyone hopes will be endless riches, and, in your case, an answer to the mystery that is Irem. In time, you reach a point where even the ceiling escapes your gaze, and were it not for the slight decline of the walkway, you might feel as if you were marching into the void, endlessly. The Acadian soldiers grow increasingly afraid, and they pepper Nutesh with requests to withdraw and return when the mist has dissipated, or at least when they can arrive in greater numbers. But every plea falls on deaf ears, as their commander advances, drawn towards the promise of treasure like a moth to a flame. Your ears, however, perk up. For, as you move deeper and deeper into the cavern, you begin to hear something creeping about, just below the walkway. At first, you thought it was just the lapping of water, but it's closer. Too close. Chancing it a few times, you've wandered near the ledge, holding your torch out over the void, hoping to glimpse something,
but the mist is so dense and the source of the sound just distant enough that you are thwarted every time. The sound begins to drive you mad, but the last thing you're going to do is turn around and head back upstairs. Not when you're this close to discovering your Ren's deepest secrets. It's then, in that moment, that you notice something in the distance. You can't be sure how far away it is or what the source might be, but the thing itself is light. Diffuse, bluish glow penetrates the mist, rising like a thonic Polaris to lead you from the bowels of Sheol. You cannot help but clamber towards it, slipping and sliding over the wet stone as you hurry towards the magnetic luminance. You shove past Nutesh and the merchants, at first drawing concerned shouts and screams, but not long after they are all running alongside you, even overtaking you as they plunge ahead with reckless abandon. Your feet carry you faster and faster, slipping and sliding as you race towards what may be a shaft of moonlight, penetrating in from some hole in the ceiling. You feel invigorated, regaining the vitality lost over the course of your desert sojourn and your rambling stay in the dark. The treasure you seek, one more valuable than any worldly goods, becomes brighter and brighter as you bound across the endless wastes. And then, you crash into something. You spin out, sliding across the floor. Your body aches, rattled from the impact, but you're so desperate to reach the light that you force yourself to your feet once more. And that's when you realize that you haven't struck some misplaced brick or tripped over some debris left behind by palace laborers. No, you struck flesh. Your companions likewise recover from having tumbled over, and with sense momentarily restored to them, they too realize the horror of what they've stumbled upon. Desiccated corpses pile up next to the short wall that forms the terminus of the walkway, an unbroken line of them stretching out in either direction as the walkway splits in two, arcing away into the mist. Everyone pushes back, leaping away from the dead, and in doing so, disturbing the network of tendrils which are still feasting upon them. The strands are thicker here, and more lively, writhing like a den of vipers or the arms of a titanic cephalopod. Some even flop about, reaching out towards you. Nutesh and his soldiers are quick to act, hacking away at the tendrils with their axes, causing them to retreat, slithering over the ledge and disappearing behind the wall of fog in front of you. And yet, confounded and terror-stricken as you are by the haunting sounds of slithering below, you catch yourself wandering along the round path, as if puppeteered by the alien luminance which permeates the veil. Your companions converge on you, pressing deeper and deeper into the mist, your eyes straining as the light nears a searing radiance. Half blind and robbed of your bodily autonomy, you continue on in this fashion until, in an instant, you feel yourself descending a set of stairs, emerging from the fog into a pocket of parched air. And no sooner than you do, the light vanishes, plunging you into deep darkness once again, with only the dimming light of your torches to provide a meager measure of sight. But you're not condemned to the void for long. Once again, a bluish glow emanates out from somewhere within the cavern. But this time, its clarity and concentration confirm that you are standing right in front of the source. And once your eyes adjust, and the glow grows stronger and stronger, you realize what it is you're looking at. Cradled in a pair of meaty, inhumanly large hands is a massive stone, through which several radiant veins of a blue crystal run, and from which several thick tendrils emerge out, splitting into a dense network that runs the length of the floor and up along the walls. The object is held aloft, growing brighter and brighter with every passing second. And as it does,
you feel yourself drawn forward once more, unable to even scream as your sandaled feet slip and slide over the pulsating masses below. With thousands of strands pouring out over every inch of stone, winding their way around the gates of the vaults which ring the perimeter, and pouring into every crack between the bricks, doubtless rising up to the city to feast upon the unfortunate souls above. And below, you feel the organism taking hold of you, its slimy mycelia wrapping around your ankles and working its way up your thighs. You see the strands seizing Nutesh, the soldiers, and the merchants as well, all of you falling prey to this otherworldly life form. You turn your eyes forward once more, setting your sights upon the source of the scourge and its unwilling caretaker. Like a mad conductor, standing atop a low rocky mound, cradling the object with all due reverence, is a man who easily towers over any other. His distressed, gangrenous frame swaddled in ornate robes, his long hair and beard wild upon his head, and his crown glimmering in the sickening glow. The Lord of Impossible Irem, the Sovereign of the Shifting Sands, King Odd, lifts the celestial intruder aloft. This king, blessed above all others, renowned across the ancient world as master of his realm, is powerless against the transfixing radiance of this alien rock and the tentacles which force themselves into his flesh, making him little more than a puppet. What all the armies of the world's four corners could not do, a hunk of cold, indifferent space debris has accomplished with ease. Irem, the legendary Atlantis of the Sands, has fallen, doomed to one day disappear beneath the sands as its denizens themselves writhe unseen in the depths, condemned to become dust. And now, you are but one among their number, your mind slipping away as the infectious rays and strands penetrate deeper and deeper into the very fiber of your being. But then, you feel a different tug on you. Your muscles, your bones, the very cells which make you whole, tingle. A new hue dominates your vision, and instead of lurching inexorably forward, you feel yourself cascading back, plucked from the precipice, and hopefully returning home.
That was The Ruin of King Odd by Kevin Valbenesi. If you enjoyed today's show, there is a bonus episode you can hear. Have a listen to this sample.
The gods who reign supreme over the lands of Arabia are a merciless lot, exacting tribute from the most desperate of tribes and rewarding them with only the most fleeting rainfall and hardly enough fertile land to survive the long, dry year. Their unbroken reign over the sand-swept wastes has smothered the aspirations of many a nation builder, suffering no structure to rise above the endlessly shifting dunes. And so it is that you find yourself traversing the sea of sand in the twilight hours, alone, riding in the direction of Shamash, freshly stirring from his slumber. As it was the day before, and the one before that, the dawn peels back the darkness, revealing the vast emptiness of the Rub al-Khali. Taking a swig of water from an animal skin bladder, you relax for a moment on top of your camel, looking up at the dazzling array of azure, marigold, and fuchsia which presage the return of the Solar King. A gentle breeze blows by, filling your robes with cool, refreshing air. Such moments are fleeting in the desert and should be taken for what they are. A concession from the brutal pantheon enthroned above. You draw strength from this meager kindness and spur on your mount, kicking up a plume behind you as the beast tears across the desert.
You ride until the moment that the tip of the radiant crown breaks over the horizon, slowing the exhausted camel to a halt at the edge of a small oasis. Once more, the wisdom of the elders has led you down the right...
That was a sample of the bonus episode for today's show. You can hear the rest when you sign up on Patreon. For the price of a latte, you'll get to hear a story that took our podcaster, Kevin Valbanese, over 8 hours to write, record, and produce. Although the truth is, Kevin has spent thousands of hours over many years to hone his craft. When you sign up to Patreon, you'll support him and all our other podcasters in what is an incredibly niche form of art. There are not many people out there who can do what these guys can do, write at this level, yet also voice act and produce audio, all within a very particular genre. It's a very rare stack of skills. You might call it a delicate flower, and it only takes you and a small handful of supporters to keep it alive. So please, become one of those special people who supports this rare art form. You can join us by visiting the website at twilighthistories.com and follow the link to Patreon, or by going directly to Patreon and looking up the Twilight Histories. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thank you for listening to the Twilight Histories. Until next time, take care.